A drought of data as the shutdown keeps going. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore in for David Brancaccio, who's on assignment. The divide is widening between what we want to know about the economy and what we don't know because of the shutdown. Every few days, there's a missed data release from the government. Diane Swonk is chief economist with tax and advisory firm Grant Thornton, is one of our regular guests to talk markets. Good morning.
Good morning.
So normally we would be talking to you about the housing starts out this morning and retail data out yesterday. But we cannot do that because the government is shut down, and so we are not getting that data. What do we know about how the economy is doing right now?
Well, we're relying more and more on anecdotal reports and private sector data because we don't have all the hard data from the U.S. Census Bureau. And so as a result, what we know is that it looks like from that data, survey data, and Beige Book, the Federal Reserve does that, that the economy was in fact beginning to slow a bit near the end of the year and as we moved into the start of this year. Not anything catastrophic, but nonetheless slowing. And the question is now we're adding insult to injury with the government shutdown. There are estimates out there that if this government shutdown were to last the entire first quarter, we could wipe out all growth in the first quarter. And these are really important things because we're sort of in a data void. It's compounding uncertainty at a time where we're already uncertain about where the economy is going.
Trade has been a big concern for markets for the past year now. It's also a big concern for the president. Shutdown has put trade deals on hold. How so?
What most people don't understand, and until it's gone, you don't miss it, but much of the trade deals, everything including the new NAFTA deal, is tentative. It needs to have all the details filled in, which requires all the people working on trade to be working and filling in those complex rules that we're going to have to go by in terms of dealing with trade with U.S. and Mexico. That can't be done if they're not at work, let alone can it be passed by Congress in a new version. And I think at best, we can get deals in principle, but this further delays our ability to solidify trade deals and actually get them approved by Congress, which is a heavy political lift as it is with a split Congress.
Diane Swonk is chief economist at the tax and advisory firm Grant Thornton. Thanks very much, as always.
Thank you.
U.S. lawmakers introduced bills in the House and Senate yesterday that would prevent the sale of U.S. chips and other technology to telecom companies that violate U.S. export controls or sanctions laws. This means Chinese firms Huawei and ZTE, among others. Senator Tom Cotton, Republican from Arkansas and one of the bill's co-sponsors, said Huawei is, quote, effectively an intelligence-gathering arm of the Chinese Communist Party. Sean Ryan is founder and managing director of China Market Research Group and author of The War for China's Wallet. He joins us from Shanghai. Good morning.
Good morning.
A spokesman for the Chinese government said this is all hysteria. Is it?
Yeah, it seems to me there's a lot of fear-mongering and hysteria in the United States because of China's rise. A lot of people in China view Trump's trade war against China as more of a way of containing China's growth and really a battle or a war for technology dominance. You saw last year that Huawei actually eclipsed Apple as the second largest mobile phone maker in the world. So for a lot of Chinese, the feeling is American government officials like Cotton are just pounding the fear in order to prevent China's rise.
Okay, but on the other hand, I mean, federal prosecutors are pursuing a criminal investigation against Huawei, alleging it stole trade secrets from U.S. firms. Is there really nothing there?
No, I think there is definitely something there that governments should be worried about. After all, Huawei, even though it's a private Chinese company, is definitely closely aligned to the Chinese Communist Party. But at the end of the day, they haven't provided any proof that there actually is something dangerous about Huawei. And frankly, the same thing could be said about Apple, which also has control of a large part of the internet space. So there's a mix of too much fear and a mix of letting things go without any danger.
How disruptive would a ban on companies like ZTE or Huawei be for both the Chinese economy and here in the U.S.?
Well, I think for China, it's very disruptive because if you were to ban or block Huawei and ZTE from getting a lot of products, that would have a direct impact on American suppliers. So, for instance, Qualcomm sells 64% of its revenue comes from selling to China. But on the bigger picture, it'll have a big issue for American consumers. If the tariffs continue and the trade war over the next couple months, prices in Walmart are going to be a lot more expensive for everyday American shoppers.
Could this possibly deter future U.S. investment or trade from other Chinese companies?
Absolutely. I'm very concerned. Chinese companies no longer want to invest in the United States. The amount of money invested by Chinese companies into the U.S. dropped 90% in 2018 from 2016, from a high of $46 billion to only $4.8 billion. So this trade war is stopping Chinese investment into the U.S., which is hurting job creation and profits for everyday Americans.
Sean Ryan is founder of the China Market Research Group. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Netflix issues its earnings after the closing bell on Wall Street today. The company just announced a subscription price hike, in part because it needs to pay for all the original shows and movies it makes. Netflix also spends a lot to license shows from the outside, like Friends and The Office. So Netflix keeps growing, but there are some threats on the horizon, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Right now, the company's sitting pretty, says Paul Verna at eMarketer.
Netflix has been and will remain the market leader for the foreseeable future.
But rivals are nipping at its heels. Amazon and Hulu are gaining subscribers. And increasingly, content producers like Disney and Warner Brothers want to stream popular shows that they own rather than license them to Netflix, says Michael Pachter at Wedbush Securities.
So if Friends goes back to Warner Brothers at the end of 2019, what happens to all the Netflix subscribers who were halfway through their Friends binge? You know, they're going to think about dropping Netflix.
James McQuivey at Forrester says that's why Netflix is investing so much to try and make its own bingeable hits.
They need to produce original content because the big studios can just turn off the faucet.
McQuivey says Netflix has a competitive advantage producing new content with voluminous customer data on what viewers like to watch. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Slabaugh from Columbus, Indiana. Make Me Smart and Marketplace are two of my favorite shows, both pushing me to think outside of my normal boundaries and making issues important to me that I wouldn't have considered before. I became a Marketplace investor because I feel it's important to vote with your dollar for media that makes a difference in the world. To join me as a Marketplace investor, donate today in whatever amount works for you at marketplace.org.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
Jack Bogle, the founder and former CEO of Vanguard, died yesterday at age 89. He's not exactly a household name, but his legacy is nothing short of democratizing investing. Under his leadership, Vanguard created the first index fund in 1975, based on Bogle's belief that brokers and investment managers can't pick individual winning stocks in the long term. And so, especially when considering the fees these managers charge, investors are better off buying low-cost index funds, which track the performance of the entire market or a select part of it, like the S&P 500. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has more on Bogle's legacy.
If a statue is ever erected to honor the person who has done the most for American investors, the hands-down choice should be Jack Bogle. So wrote legendary investor Warren Buffett in a 2017 letter to his shareholders. He's a hero to them and to me, Buffett added. Jack Bogle responded on CNBC.
And I'm not a hero. I'm an ordinary guy, very ordinary guy, who's tried to do my best for investors and who gave a damn about the people who are investing and wanted to make sure they got a fair shake.
But Bogle and the index fund did revolutionize investing, says Dennis Kelleher, president of the nonprofit Better Markets.
The creation of the index fund democratized the stock markets by enabling the middle class to actually invest in the stock markets, where historically it has really been limited to the very, very wealthy who could afford brokers and special advisors.
Bogle retired from Vanguard in 1996. The firm now manages $5 trillion in assets. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Artificial intelligence is used to figure out what movies we might like to watch, what music we might like to listen to, who we might be into on dating apps. But when machines learn from humans, they can also learn human biases, including race and gender biases. That's a problem when companies use AI to try to decide who to hire, for example. Hannah Harris Green reports on how some companies and engineers are working to make AI fairer.
Talia Goldstein is the CEO of 3-Day Rule, an in-person matchmaking service headquartered in Los Angeles. At first, her hiring requirements were strict.
I believed that matchmakers should be in their mid to late 30s, married, and having gone to Harvard Business School. And I was hiring very specifically for that.
But then she began to use ZipRecruiter to find employees. ZipRecruiter is a company that matches potential employees to potential jobs. It uses artificial intelligence to find matches. Other recruiters do too, like Symphony Talent and Textio. Goldstein says ZipRecruiter helped broaden her thoughts about who to hire when it came to age and education, and wound up hiring people younger than her ideal age range, who did well.
Someone who is 23 and this is her second job can be just as successful as a Harvard Business School grad in their late 30s.
Job matching means feeding lots of data into a computer about who companies hire. The AI system then creates an algorithm that can scan resumes and decide whether someone looks like a good candidate. But if the algorithm imitates companies that have discriminatory hiring practices, it will also discriminate. When ZipRecruiter engineers began developing AI algorithms, CEO Ian Siegel says he was aware of this possibility and found ways to prevent it.
We consciously remove as much information that could lead to bias as possible. If you have the term waiter and you have the term waitress, always use the term waiter.
Phoebe Vianos, Associate Director of the Center for AI and Society at the University of Southern California, says simply removing characteristics like gender or ethnicity isn't always enough.
The reason is that some of these characteristics may be correlated with others.
So even if a characteristic like ethnicity is hidden from the algorithm, it could still discriminate based on something else statistically linked to ethnicity, like education level. Bayanyo says that with careful engineering, AI decisions can be designed to be fairer than human ones, but only if engineers keep that goal in mind. In Los Angeles, I'm Hannah Harris Green for Marketplace.
And in New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.